to power in Germany and the advent of Nazism, the diaspora gave another message to the Jews. Not only that they are second or third or fourth rate citizens, not only that they are not wanted among these countries, but they are not wanted in this world. And this was a strong message. We should not belittle this. And I'm sure that if United States and Canada had opened their gates to Jewish emigration in the 30s and the 40s, not just, you know, some select celebrities like Einstein or I don't know what, or Hannah Arendt, but the masses, the proletariat, the poor people, if they had accepted them all, they wouldn't have come to Palestine. They would have been saved, many of them would have been saved, and they wouldn't have emigrated to Palestine. Okay, so Jews came, and it's at the expense of Palestinians. So if we really wanted a refuge, and if we really wanted to build a model society, first of all, we would have accepted the Palestinians back, those who were expelled or ran away or were not in the country in 1948. I know it is, today it sounds completely hypothetical, but we had several opportunities over the years to build another course, not to remain a foreign entity, foreign European entity within an Arab world. We decide to be so, and for this we have to permanently rely on the military strength, expand this military strength, and then export it to the world, and then export it to murderous regimes all over the world for profit. So this is Israel. And I don't think that this is something that I would, you know, that I feel solidarity with this, the need of Jews to have allegiance to this kind of Israel.
Amira Haas spoke at the Broadway United Methodist Church in Chicago on May 5, 2019. You heard excerpts from a recording produced by Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio and posted online at Radio for All. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
And this is KBOO Portland. We're coming up on time. Well, it's a little after 10 a.m. and time for Voices for the Animals. So we'll just jump right to it.
Listening to Voices for the Animals on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals. I'm your host, Deb Stedman, and my guest today is Carrie Teal, the co-founder and executive director of Gray2K USA Worldwide, an organization dedicated to ending the cruelty of dog racing in the U.S. and abroad. Carrie has been working tirelessly to this end since 2001, authoring hundreds of articles and testifying before legislative committees in several states for stronger greyhound protection laws, all of which has made him the go-to animal rights expert in the field of dog racing. And I might add that Carrie is also renowned as a national chess master, and that I knew him as a teenager when he was a top-ranked junior chess player right here in Portland. So it's especially nice to be talking with him today. Welcome to the program, Carrie.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be on. It's a great honor. So thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, great. So why don't we start by hearing about your organization and its special mission within the animal rights movement? How did you personally get involved with helping greyhounds in the first place?
Sure. Well, like you said, I'm from Portland originally. I miss Portland. It'll always be my home. I still have family there, so you know, it's and that makes the show even more special today. But there was a movement to end greyhound racing that preceded me and my work and our organization. It was a grassroots movement that fought for these dogs all over the country, and it sort of bubbled up into a political campaign in the year 2000 in the state of Massachusetts to completely outlaw greyhound racing in the Bay State. And I came from Portland out to Boston to work on that campaign after having worked on the Oregon Barrancour Coalition campaign and other efforts. My mother was the founder of or the president for many years of People for Animal Rights, so I had an animal welfare, animal protection background. And we put before voters a ballot question to phase out greyhound racing completely in Massachusetts, which was historic and something that had never happened before. And we ran what we thought was a great campaign, although in hindsight, of course, we made, you know, plenty of mistakes. And on election day, after having been sued for $10 million and really just for a very, very rough and tumble fight, we lost 51-49 in what was one of the closest ballot questions in state history. And so, you know, that was a terrible, terrible day to lose such an important campaign by such a close margin and know that, you know, greyhounds would continue to suffer. But it also showed us that we could take on this powerful industry and have an impact. And so we formed a national nonprofit after that, and we've been fighting for the greyhounds ever since.
Yeah, and we might want to add that I'm not sure the timing of this, but the other co-founder of Grey2K USA Worldwide is your now wife, who happens to be an attorney. So I'm sure when those lawsuits started piling up, that was reassuring in a couple of different ways.
Yeah, our co-founder's name Christine Dorchek, and she's not only an attorney, she never stops working, and is incredibly compassionate, just a really powerful person. So I'm very fortunate. But you know, it's been an incredible journey over the last 20 odd years, and we just won. I don't want to jump ahead, but we just won an incredible landmark victory outlawing greyhound racing in the state of Florida.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a little while, but right now I'd like to ask you something that I read on your website about the three main strategies that you use for reaching your goals. The first one was legislation, increase awareness, and promote adoption. So if you could say a little bit about each of those areas as your strategies, that would be great.
You know, I think one of the things that makes our work a little bit unique is that, you know, we have been taking on an industry that it was and still is politically powerful, economically significant, culturally significant, and we're not looking to just reform the industry, although we do fight for reforms, but we're looking to completely prohibit the industry. And so, you know, we might be the only effort, you know, anywhere in the movement to take on an industry, you know, that's that politically oriented and powerful and completely outlaw. And so I think that's, you know, brings a sharpness to our work and really has forced us to, you know, figure out how to use the legislative process and the democratic process to fight for animals in ways that I think we wouldn't have had to learn to do otherwise. You know, I mean, these tracks in many states have had lobbyists and been making campaign contributions and had relationships with lawmakers for not just decades, but really generations. I mean, Multnomah Greyhound Park in Portland was a great example of that. There are still lobbyists in Salem today who are, you know, family relations of some of the founders of the greyhound racing industry. And so, you know, I think that in some ways it was an experiment to see, you know, how good could we get at fighting for animals in that way. And it's, you know, in an age when our democracy feels so broken and dysfunctional, and our politics are so, just completely, black or white. It's, heartening that we've been able to make so much progress, and sometimes I feel like we're sort of like the last bipartisan issue.
I know that you've grown your organization to be the biggest the largest organization that is whose aim is to protect the greyhounds and to shut down the tracks. Now let me ask you, Carrie, from the outside looking in, many folks don't always see the harm in greyhound racing, but we know that there is a lot of harm. Can you please tell us about the many problems inherent in the commercial dog racing business?
Of course. Yeah, well, it starts, at the track. I mean, you have a huge number of dogs, hundreds of dogs that are kept in warehouse-style kennel compounds. These are, large compounds with guard shacks and barbed wire fences, and within these compounds there are long narrow buildings, and dogs are kept in rows of stacked metal cages for roughly 22 hours a day, and that's their life. They're let out to relieve themselves a few times a day, a few times a month they're taken to the track, but their life is a life of confinement. At the track, the dogs are always at risk of serious injury. Dogs die, for example, on Florida racetracks. Every 3 days, a greyhound dies on a Florida racetrack. Dogs suffer broken bones, broken necks, paralysis. And there are also just a lot of industry standard practices that are used to secure the highest return for each individual dog while incurring the least amount of cost. So that means things like using 4-D meat from downed animals as a primary food source, or giving all female greyhounds doses of anabolic steroids to prevent them from coming into heat. The industry uses a lot of factory farming products for things like flea and tick control. Drugs are a serious problem in the industry. We've seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of drug positives for everything from dexamethasone, which is used to treat certain cancers, to cocaine or serious opiates. So it's just an industry that, looks at dogs as numbers to gamble on and tries to, secure the highest economic return from each individual dog. And as a result, thousands and thousands of greyhounds suffer. It's not a way that we would treat our own dogs. And I think one of the things that this fight has taught me is that, and I know you've had this theme, I'm sure, with all of you guests, but I mean, animal welfare really is just a fundamental part of who we are as Americans. It's a part of our culture. It's a part of our identity. And so, to see dogs treated this way is something that just crosses all barriers, ideological, geographic, age. It's a uniter. So that's the heart of our campaign, and it's been very powerful.
Great. But how many serious dog injuries or deaths occur every year in the United States on the tracks, or related to the greyhound dog racing industry?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have a complete total because many states don't report. Florida, for example, which is the largest state, there are currently 13 operational dog tracks. 7 of those are in Florida, and those are going to go away by the end of 2020. But none of those tracks, with one exception, report greyhound injuries at all. So, we do have data from some states, and those show just hundreds and hundreds of greyhound injuries every single year. But other states, it's just a black hole. It's like the industry's dirty little secret. But we did do a complete analysis of the injuries we could find nationwide a few years ago, and we found over a few years, about 15,000 greyhound injuries. But I think honestly, that's not even the full picture. It's if a dog races,
those are the ones that were reported that you do know about.
Correct.
Yeah,
that's right. And I mean, if a dog races long enough on a commercial racetrack, it becomes more likely than not that the dog will be seriously injured.
I know your website mentions broken legs, head trauma, electrocution, which I I don't even want to think about that one.
Yeah, well, the dog can fall into the racetrack rail and be electrocuted. I mean, that's a rarer injury. That's not something that you see commonly, but the broken legs are extraordinarily common. I mean, my understanding is that at one Florida racetrack, for example, and this is what I've we don't have concrete data for this track, but I have been told by industry insiders that there's 100 plus broken legs, for example, at one particular Florida track each year. So, broken legs are just a part of the industry that you see at every track throughout the country.
Right, and we don't want to forget the poor little animals that are used as live lures in training.
Yeah, the industry claims that doesn't happen anymore, but I believe it does, and it certainly happens overseas. I mean, there have been some cases, there have been a few cases domestically, but there was a massive scandal in the Australian greyhound racing industry just a couple of years ago in which they were using live piglets, live rabbits. So, live lure training is certainly a part of the problem. But, to me, these are such beautiful, majestic dogs. They do love to run, and to keep a dog like that in a cage for 22 yeah. hours a day is just cruel and inhumane, and there's no, I mean, you for me, you can stop there.
Yeah, you need not go any further. Okay, right. Carrie, we're going to have to take a little break now, a brief break, so everyone, please stay tuned. Back, and you're listening to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. We've been talking with Carrie Teal, the Executive Director of Gray2K USA Worldwide, about the many problems associated with greyhound racing and what his organization is doing to end them. Carrie, your website has a lot of information about the numerous campaigns you've undertaken since 2001 dealing with issues surrounding dog racing. The long list of your accomplishments is very impressive. Can you talk about some of your major successes since you started advocating for the greyhounds, including your huge win last November in the state of Florida that you mentioned previously? Go ahead. Go at it. You deserve some kudos for this. Yeah.
Well, you're very kind. But no, I mean, look, the legislative process is difficult. It's meant to be difficult. It was designed to be difficult. And so, there have been many campaigns that have taken us years to eventually win. After our initial defeat in Massachusetts, it took us 8 full years to come back and bring another vote to the people to outlaw greyhound racing. When we did, and it came back before voters in 2008, and we won a sweeping victory, closing down 2 long-standing tracks where many dogs had died, and carried 12 of 14 counties. I mean, that was a real moment when we knew that we could, use the democratic process to fight for these dogs and really win powerful results. We've worked in the state legislatures in many states. We've passed prohibitions on commercial dog racing in 6 states. We've passed 18 major greyhound protection laws. All of those were intense, difficult campaigns. But Florida really was, though, something that, was just so incredibly powerful.
Because you used an initiative process and got on the state ballot, right?
Well, we did. We used a similar process. Florida has this quirky law that says every 20 years, there's a special panel that's created that can propose constitutional amendments to the voters. And we use that process. We place a constitutional amendment to completely outlaw greyhound racing before voters. This is an amendment that would close 11 dog tracks. Just a sweeping victory. I really believe, just as an animal advocate personally, one of the most sweeping victories our movement has ever won. And we ran a good campaign. We had unbelievable support and very bipartisan support. We had Andrew Gillum, who is the Democratic nominee for governor, and Laura Trump supporting the campaign. We had Mike Huckabee and the League of Women Voters. We had the Florida College Democrats, and the sitting Attorney General Pam Bondi and the sitting Republican Governor Rick Scott. I mean, just you know, people on
broad-based support. That's amazing. Yeah,
it was unbelievable support, and we ran a great campaign, and we won with a sweeping 69% win in a conservative state on a night when a conservative governor was elected. So it just unbelievable. And as a result of that vote, four dog tracks have already closed. Seven more dog tracks are going to close in the next year and a half, and you know, thousands of dogs are going to be saved. I mean, just countless dogs are going to be saved from lives of confinement and racetrack deaths. And so that was, you know, after all the hard work and all of. I mean, we had many setbacks. There are many moments when we wondered, could we do this? You know, was this possible? Was the industry too powerful? But we kept fighting. We kept believing in our mission. We kept working for the dogs. We kept working the problem, and we eventually won the sweeping victory. And it was you know, I will tell you, it was a strange experience winning this huge victory and having the sense that there's probably not much else professionally in your life you could do to top that. So that was interesting, but no, it was really powerful. And Christine and I and everyone who was involved in this just feel so fortunate to be able to fight this fight and be a part of that and live through history. It's
It was an awesome victory, and congratulations, really. It's something you can be proud of, and knowing how many Greyhound lives and all the suffering and everything that you have prevented. And also, there are ancillary benefits, too, because now breeding and gambling and, you know, some of those things associated with the tracks, those are all going to be decreasing as well, right?
Oh, no question. As much as this is going to help Greyhounds, I think this is a victory for all of us. It's a testament to the good people of Florida. It's a testament to who we are as Americans. It's a landmark victory for the animal welfare community that is going to, without question, help and encourage further victories. You know, in all sorts of areas. It's a really beautiful thing. It's a moment of compassion that I think, you know, is not our victory. It's everyone's victory, and it was cool to be a part of it.
Yeah, really. Well, let me ask you at this point, how many tracks are still open in how many states?
Well, once the Florida victory fully takes effect, there's going to be six dog tracks remaining in five states. Now, to put that in context, at its peak, there were more than 60 operational dog tracks in 19 states. So you're really talking about, you know, a complete collapse of the industry. And, you know, the two main states where Greyhound racing will continue are West Virginia and Arkansas. And I think in the coming years, there will be a national effort to say, you know, do West Virginia and Arkansas really want to be the last states to have commercial greyhound racing? I view it as similar to the endgame fight over cockfighting, which, as you know, continued into the mid-90s, with Louisiana being the final state to allow cockfighting. Not to say that cockfighting and greyhound racing are exactly the same, but I think the end game for greyhound racing is going to be very similar to the end game that we saw with cockfighting in the 90s. And, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that we're going to win and we're going to end greyhound racing nationwide. I think the question is how long is that going to take and how many dogs are going to suffer in the meantime. But we're going to keep fighting, and with everyone's help and support, we're going to get the job done.
You betcha. Okay, now your organization also works in foreign countries doing investigations and trying to get more protections for the dogs there and even closing down tracks. Do you want to talk about the global situation a little
bit,
whether you think it's improving and whether you've had any victories in foreign lands as well?
Well, greyhound racing does exist in a few other countries. There's a large commercial greyhound racing industry in Australia, and there's a large commercial greyhound racing in the UK and Ireland. The dogs are bred in Ireland and mostly race in the UK, although there are some Irish tracks as well. And then there's a few small greyhound racing industries. There's a track in Vietnam, for example, which is of great concern. We are doing a lot of international work. Christine just led a campaign along with some a local partner to close the only legal dog track in China, which was called the Canadrome and was in Macau.
Yeah, that was a big one, right? 500 dogs or something. Yeah,
huge victory. Worst dog track in the world. And in fact, one of the dogs who was rescued from that campaign, who's named Brooklyn and was a poster child, is now with us. And that it's so powerful to have him here and to be able to. He's 10 years old. He unfortunately was just diagnosed with cancer, but he's an incredibly sweet dog. Everybody loves this dog, and to be with Brooklyn every day and be able to give him, you know, a good life for as long as he's going to have is just an incredible blessing, just so powerful. But, you know, I think as we finish the job in the U.S., we are going to transition and do more international work. There are incredible greyhound advocates fighting for these dogs all over the world, and you know, to whatever degree we can be of service to them and be an ally to them, that's something that we have, you know, strong ambitions in the years to come. So.
Well, it's really good to know that there are other groups in other countries that you can partner with to achieve, you know, the end of greyhound racing worldwide. That would be terrific.
Yeah, I think we'll get there. I do, and it's like I said, there's just really special people fighting for these dogs all over the place.
And I think you're one of them, definitely. Okay, Carrie, but with so many tracks now either closed or closing down, do you think it's possible that we'll witness an end to dog racing, at least here in the United States, in the foreseeable future?
No question. You know, whether that's going to take 3 years or, you know, another decade, you know, I can't say. But I think in the coming years, there's no question in my mind that we're going to see greyhound racing end in the United States completely.
Okay. And what kind of action can our listeners take to help bring about this goal? I know that there were some things that were suggested on your website.
Well, you know, we obviously... We do exist on donations, so if people are able to donate anything, be a monthly donor or make individual donations, that would be extremely helpful. We're very effective on a small budget, so that's a really key area of support that we need. If you're looking to adopt, consider adopting a greyhound. They make wonderful companions. They're such sweet dogs. And then the final thing I would say is, don't give up hope in our democracy. I understand, you know, how difficult things are now and how polarized and how dysfunctional it seems, but I can tell you from firsthand experience, our democracy still works. It can still address social justice issues, and we are incredibly fortunate to have this available to us. So, you know, whatever issue people want to work on, find a way to engage and use this process.
Right. You mentioned petitions or contacting your state governor or even setting up an outreach table.
Yeah, that's right. Local officials. I mean, it's you know, a lot of places in the world, we don't have this opportunity. People don't have this opportunity to fight in this way for social change. It's like the last, like I said earlier, I felt in Florida, you know, I'm personally progressive. I became very close friends with you know, folks on the right, and I often felt like I was working on the last bipartisan issue.
Okay. So. Okay. All right, Carrie, we're kind of running out of time here. Last but not least, I am also very grateful to you, our listeners, for your abiding interest and support of this program. Thank you all very much. And so I will sign off this one last time, as always, with the important reminder that you too can be a voice for the animals.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU. in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salmon Cycling Classic on Saturday, June 29th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Wilsonville Memorial Park in Wilsonville. The Salmon Cycling Classic is a social ride through the outskirts of Portland featuring rides of 90, 60, and 25 kilometers. This ride shows community support for the development of the French Prairie Bridge, a planned bicycle pedestrian bridge over the Willamette River in Wilsonville. Again, that's the Salmon Cycling Classic on Saturday, June 29th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Wilsonville Memorial Park in Wilsonville. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's about 10:30, which means it's time for film at 11. And it's time for me to remind you, which is my honor, privilege, as well as contractual obligation, that KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Darkside Cinema, open every night featuring independent, foreign, and art house films. The Darkside is located... That is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson Avenues in Corvallis, Oregon. More information and showtimes available online at darksidecinema.com.
Okay, film at 11 it is at 10:30, as always. And we're